In this episode, we talk with Susan Parson, Special Technical Assistant in the FAA Flight Standards Service and editor of FAA Safety Briefing Magazine. In the news, we discuss the electrically powered planes, an important approved model list STC, the FAA teams up with the auto industry, airlines restricting fare bargains, a play about United Flight 232, and Solar Impulse 2 returns to mission mode. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 397 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and joining me is first our aviation historian, David Vanderhoof. Hey, David.
Hi, Max. It's going to be a great show tonight, and I'm really excited about this week because I get to spend this weekend down at Langley with NASA and the base, and Raptor. So I'm looking forward to a really good week. The weekend can't come soon enough.
All right. Well, we'll talk about that a little bit later. Also with us, we have our associate producer, Brian Coleman.
Hi, Max. Hope all's well.
Yep. You and I are back from Aviation Geek Fest 2016. We're going to give a little bit of a debrief on that coming up also.
And if I sound a little bit funnier tonight, I'm suffering a little bit from a cold and I got braces.
Seriously? Did you?
Seriously. Well, they're Invisaligns, but they kind of count as braces.
All right. Well, we'll look forward to a new and improved smile at some point down the road. Let me introduce the other Max, Max Trescott. Sometimes we call him Max West. He's a CFI, an author, and a glass cockpit expert. Hey, Max.
Hey, hello, Max, and fellow co-hosts and Airplane Geeks listeners around the world. I had a super weekend at the Monterey Bay, hanging out nice, cool weather this weekend, and spent first part of today off teaching flying in a Cirrus. So you know what that means. It's just it's been a good last few couple of days.
Doesn't get much better.
No, sure doesn't.
Rob Mark, our aviation journalist and publisher of the Jetwine blog, is off this episode. He's nursing the flu, so we'll wish him a speedy recovery. Hopefully, Rob will be back with us next week. Our guest for this episode is Susan Parson. She's Special Technical Assistant with the FAA Flight Standards Service. She's also editor of FAA Safety Briefing Magazine. Susan started with the FAA in the General Aviation and Commercial Division of the FAA Flight Standards Service, the AFS, and she became Special Technical Assistant to the Director of the AFS. She manages the director's internal and external communications, as well as being editor of the FAA Safety Briefing Magazine. Now, Susan serves as the lead FAA representative for the Airman Certifications Standards, the ACS, that project to improve airman testing and training. Susan has authored over 90 GA safety articles, several online training documents, and courses. She holds an ATP certificate, as well as ground and flight instructor certificates with instrument, single engine, and multi-engine land ratings. Susan's also an active GA pilot. She instructs on weekends for her Cessna 182 Flying Club, also for the Civil Air Patrol. She's created a number of advanced avionics training courses and modules for the Civil Air Patrol, and she's the primary author of CAP's National Check Pilot Standardization course. Susan, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm really glad to be here.
You've been immersed in aviation for quite a while, I take it. Did you start your interest in flying at a young age?
You know, I think I'm one of those people who was born an airplane junkie from the time that I was about 3 years old. I remember looking up in the sky, and I played pilot and I played all sorts of things, but the time and the money and the opportunity to fly didn't all come together for me. Probably the money still didn't, but I didn't care about that point. when I was in my late 20s and I was back from a second foreign service tour overseas, and I decided, you know, I really want to do this, but I honestly didn't think I was smart enough. So I started ground school and then I did flight training. And once I got started, I kept going. So I've loved aviation all my life, but I didn't start flying until my late 20s.
Oh.
But hey, I'm trying to make up for lost time.
I think you're doing a good job of it as well. All right. Well, Susan has to move on to some other things this evening. So we're going to start the show with our main topic. So if everyone's ready, we'll start with our conversation with Susan. All right, Susan, let's start off. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about the Airman Certifications Standards Project. Just exactly what is that project? Why is it important?
Well, if you can remember, think back to when you took your knowledge test, you probably came across, whether you were studying or you were actually taking the test, I suspect you came across some questions that you thought, why in the world am I studying that? And I certainly know that when I taught ground school and I was having to teach the fixed card ADS formula, one of my standard lines was, okay, you're going to need to know this for the knowledge test, but don't worry, you're never going to have to use it again. And this was long before I started working for the FAA, but I really, really disliked having to spend time having people learn things that I knew they didn't need to know. And I used to be very frustrated when I would do multiple interpolations for something like a half gallon difference in fuel burn. So I've long had an interest in trying to do something to improve FAA knowledge tests, but the opportunity arose back in 2011, and we put together a group of industry experts from just about every field that you can imagine and started to take a look at how we could make it better. So that's how the Airman Certification Standards started. What it has become is, I like to call it a souped-up version of the PTS. So it still has all the same skills in the PTS, the same performance values, everything that you're familiar with. But included in the ACS are also now elements for the knowledge exam. So now you know what you really have to study and whether it's meaningful, how it's connected to the task. And instead of just words in the front of the PTS that say you need risk management and special emphasis and aeronautical decision making, those have been defined as specific behaviors and practices and incorporated into the task. So essentially for each area of operation and task in the PTS, the knowledge and the risk management pieces are included with it. So as we like to say, it's a comprehensive standard for both the knowledge and the practical exams, and it tells you what you need to know, consider, and do to be to operate safely in the NAS. And everybody who's involved in it thinks that this is just a dramatically better way to train and certificate pilots.
It sounds like it's learning with more context. I think it's easier to learn something in a meaningful way that you retain and that you can use if you understand the context that it's placed in.
Absolutely. See, I grew up in a family of teachers. I swore I wasn't going to be one myself until I decided to become a flight instructor. So I guess I didn't escape after all. But I was very interested in educational theory. I did a master's in education a few years ago. And there were some things about how people learn things that they feel like they need to know or that are of value to them. And the way that we have always presented material in the past, certainly when you're doing things like we actually had a test question no longer exists of what is the height of blowing sand? Why do you need to know that? But on the other hand, if you connect the knowledge and the behaviors to the skill and, okay, so this is why I need to know this. For example, now instead of being a special emphasis item, a land and hold short operations, that's incorporated in the appropriate task. So now you have, because you have it in context, you know why you need to know it. And that's not only motivation, but it just makes sense to learn things in context.
And I guess where we got to, the kind of what we have up into this change, really was what? Just kind of grew organically and never really had this kind of structured approach?
Well, actually, that's an interesting question, Max. As I got into it, I came to realize that years ago, the FAA developed the practical test standards as a way to standardize the conduct of the practical test. So if you think about it this way, for every certificate and rating, the regulations say that you have to have these aeronautical knowledge, and there's a list of things. They call it flight proficiency, and there's a list of things. And then there's aeronautical experience, and we all know, so many hours of cross-country and so on. But for the skill part, the practical test standard says, okay, you have to hold an altitude within 100 feet or whatever it is for that certificate of rating. But we have never had any kind of equivalent, you could call it a KTS or a knowledge test standard, for the knowledge exam part. And originally, when the working group got together, and this is the industry folks and FA folks, we started off thinking that we were going to do a knowledge test standard so that it would be structured. And then one of our members pretty quickly said, well, why would you do that? Why not put it together? And the ACS was born from that. And it, as we all say, it just makes sense. So now it will continue to be a living document, but for every area of operation and task, now you have, if you're a student, you know what you need to study and why. And if you're an instructor, and heaven knows, I really wish I'd had this when I first started teaching. And for an evaluator, some of the things that you've had to try to figure out, like, well, how do you test risk management, or how do you test decision making? Now there's a lot more context and specificity around it. I even said that word.
Yeah, well, let's talk about risk management. I've often said that we can virtually teach a monkey how to learn how to fly, but it's the judgment aspect which is so incredibly important for pilots to learn. And yet the PTS really hasn't spent nearly as much time on risk management as it has on, hey, can you hold this bank angle plus or minus 5 degrees? Talk about the risk management. What's new and what's different there?
Well, what's new and what's different is that it puts instead of just saying that you need to exercise risk management, it puts in the things that you need to consider. For example, you need to consider the effects of density altitude. Now, it's one thing to have the knowledge, but if you consider the effects of density altitude in takeoff planning from a high altitude runway or on a hot day or something, and it specifically says that you need to consider that, it gives you a lot more to work with and a lot more of the why. One thing I'd like to stress, sometimes I think people think that the ACS means that there's less emphasis on stick and rudder training, and that's not true. The idea is that you're going to get the same airplane control training that you always did, only this time it will also include the what do you need to know to do this and what do you need to consider to do it safely.
So I'm dying to know, what was the old answer to the height of blowing sand since I flew across some a few weeks ago in Arizona?
Well, actually, that was since I spend a lot of time in Arizona, that was one of the things that outraged me about the question. It was just wrong. It said, I think it was something like 50 feet, 150 feet, or 200 feet. And all I could think was, oh, you've never been to Arizona. We grow them a lot bigger than that.
I was going to say, I watched it go at least 6,000 feet into the air, and we flew around it. So that's just totally absolutely crazy.
Huh. Well, it was pretty funny, actually. And, you look at it and say, well, why would we be asking that? And what point is it? So one of the things that we've been doing, the ACS, there is now a unique code associated with each task element, whether it's knowledge, risk management, or skill. And eventually we're going to be able to print those on the Airman Knowledge Test Report. But right now the FAA is already using those codes in the background to go through the test questions and to eliminate things like the height of blowing sand, because we can look at a question and see if it matches up to something in the standard that our industry colleagues have helped us develop. And if the question doesn't fit anywhere, it goes away.
Is that also true?
Blowing sand didn't fit anywhere. Sorry?
Now, is that also true for the PTS in terms of having codes that tie back? Because I know a local designated pilot examiner had told me that there are items today on the private check ride which absolutely, you cannot find a reference for.
Well, the codes will be the PCS is a skill, but if you're talking about the learning statement codes that are used today and will still be used for a little while to come, learning statement codes were a good idea. They're the ones that you see on an Airman Knowledge Test report as PLT codes. But the problem was they are anchored in references and not in the standard. And so you end up having PLT codes that they've proliferated. There are kind of too many of them to be useful, and they can point in too many different directions. And I think that's what you're asking about, Max, because when evaluators do when they do the oral part of the practical test, they can look at the codes and think, well, this could be this or that or the other, and they ask the student, what did you miss? And they may or may not know. But the ACS, because there's a unique code for each task element, and again, it's anchored in the standard, it will be much, much easier for people to retest and retrain. So there are a lot of benefits to that part of it, too, and hopefully we'll be able to show that in the not too distant future.
This sounds like it was an octopus to get your arms around this thing. How did you manage to get a team together to work on this?
Well, when it started off, I was fortunate enough to know to have met quite a few people, and I knew that, let's put it this way, I knew that I was not the only one who had a certain amount of dissatisfaction with the knowledge test. So what we wanted to do was to get a group of representatives, and this would be courseware providers, aviation associations, people from academia, University Aviation Association, for example, manufacturers, everybody that we could think of who might have an interest. And I put together a list of the different constituencies and the name for each one, and it was kind of fun. I called them up and said, so we're thinking about doing this. Would you be interested? And with everybody I called, I barely got the sentence out before the answer was, yes, I'm in. And so the first group kind of came to the recommendation that we needed to take this integrated airman certification standards approach. We've had two working groups since. One completed its work, and the third one is still ongoing. And in those cases, we did what government does. We solicited for membership in the Federal Register, and people who wanted to participate let us know. And we did the same kind of thing, trying to select from representative constituencies and get a diverse group of knowledgeable people. One of the reasons it's so important for the FAA to do this is that we are not able to, however much I like to fly, I can't be out there as much as you are. I mean, you're talking about flying this morning, Max, and I'm jealous.
Well, that's why I mentioned it specifically.
I knew.
No, I'm kidding. Go ahead.
I'll get you for that later. But what we want is to be sure that the test is relevant and meaningful, and that means we need to draw on the expertise of people who are out there doing, you know, what you might call boots on the ground flight training every single day. And that's the beauty of this, that we have a lot of different interests that have come together, but everybody has the common goal of making it better, because we all want to have people who are safe and effective in our national airspace system.
This is very interesting. Susan, I think that over the years, as my knowledge about the FAA has grown, I've come to see time and again where the FAA develops new things, not by just sitting around with a couple of FAA employees in an FAA conference room, but really does engage the different groups that represent different aviation interests, manufacturers, just a whole broad spectrum. It's kind of an interesting process. Is that sort of the norm for the FAA when it comes to creating something new?
I think it's becoming more so because the agency recognizes the need for expertise outside. I think historically maybe it was a little bit more internal, and that was one of the reasons we had some issues with the knowledge test. But I want to stress a couple of things, though. First of all, we have, I'm sure you're going to be shocked to hear that there are a lot of processes we have to observe to make sure that you know we're following rules and laws and procedures. So there's something called the Federal Advisory Committee Act, and everything that we're doing is consistent with that. So that's why we've set up the groups the way that we have. The working group is doing a huge amount of totally free to the government development work on the ACS, Recommendations on the handbooks. They've given us tons of recommendations to update things like the Pilot's Handbook of Aeronautical Knowledge and the Airplane Flying Handbook. And also, I'm going to say, I'll call it test management practices. But it's really important for everybody to understand that the group is not seeing or developing test questions. That's still being done internally, but and as it should be, because we have to protect the integrity of the test. But we are trying to benefit from the fact that lots of people know a lot more than we do about what I like to call the dark art of developing a question. You know, writing good test questions is hard.
It sure is, yes.
And we have, we've benefited from the expertise of people who have some training and experience in that. And they've said, well, you know, here's the way that you want to think about it. You want to, there's no reason to ask what is X when X is an acronym. You need to put that in some kind of context for people. So we are learning to develop better questions and using the ACS and that coding system to make sure that the questions we develop or revise, that they really are tied to the standard. So as I said, it was pretty easy to throw out what is the height of blowing sand. That doesn't fit anywhere and it doesn't need to. So goodbye.
Well, especially if it's wrong. So when does this take effect? Because I'm sure there may be student pilots out there thinking about, oh, I'm going to take my knowledge exam. When do the questions change?
Well, guess what? They already have. If anybody who is taking a private pilot airplane, and by the way, we're just starting with airplane for now. This is one of those, you called it an octopus, Max, but I like to call it an elephant. You have to carve off a piece and start chewing and then go get another one. So we decided that we would start with the airplane category, and we would start with private pilot airplane and the instrument rating for airplane, because those are going to cover a fairly broad spectrum of people who are just starting in aviation. So we have used the ACS for private airplane and instrument rating airplane to code and revise all of the active knowledge test questions for those two knowledge tests today. So they line up already with the ACS. And if you were looking and studying for the ACS right now, you're going to be better prepared for not just the knowledge exam, but the practical test, all aspects of it, and most importantly, to operate safely. Hmm. So the transition, I think people worry about it a little bit, but really, this is a better tool to do what you're already doing. It's not intended to change and certainly not lengthen the check ride. It is not, it's really not going to change the way anybody works, but instead of having to figure out, now, gee, what might they ask me on the knowledge test? And do I need to study, do I need to do these 3-hour problems for a 2-hour test? And actually we found some of those, by the way. It's going to give everybody a better tool to do the job. And we don't expect that anybody's going to have a tough time in transition. And in fact, we've been prototype testing both the private and the instrument in two places, Orlando and Seattle, for the last 18 months. And the people who've used it love it. And they kind of come to us and say, okay, so how soon can we have this? So we've had an amazingly positive response to it.
Hey, Susan, I was going to say, this seems so, I don't know, practical and simple and obvious. One of the things that I do, I also teach scuba diving, and it seems like this practice and principle could be moved over to the scuba certifying agencies and improve their testing procedures. Is there any thought into doing some knowledge transfer on this type of stuff?
That hadn't occurred to me until you just asked me. I certainly... What we have done is freely available. If you look on the FAA webpage, and I could give you the link, but it's one of those longer URLs. But if you were to Google Airman Certification Standards or Airman Testing, there's an FAA webpage where we have copies of the private and instrument ACS, frequently asked questions. There's a brochure. We have sample knowledge tests for private and instrument. We have a presentation on the ACS, which provides some background material. And as of today, there's also an Understanding the ACS course on fasafety.gov, so you can get WINGS credit for it. So So there's a lot of information there if you or other people want to use it to, first of all, learn about the ACS, but second, to look at how that might be transferred. And if you can think of ways to do that, I'm sure that the folks on the group would be more than happy to talk about how we've gone about doing it.
Interesting. Almost in a sort of a similar vein, are you aware, Susan, of this process that's used in other countries and how that's different or the same from what we're looking at here in the U.S.?
Well, I'm not aware that anybody else is doing it quite the way we are. Early on, we looked at, you know, we want to make sure, obviously, that whatever we're doing is consistent with ICAO standards, the International Civil Aviation Organization. And there's nothing that says that we can't construct our knowledge test however we need to. And, of course, everything in our knowledge test is aligned with our regulations and procedures. I do know that our colleagues in Europe and in Canada have been briefed on what we're doing periodically, and they're certainly interested in it. So it would be interesting. I think they may be interested to see how it's going to work for us. And, again, would be most happy to provide briefings and information to anybody who needs to know.
Interesting.
So knowledge tests are changed already. What about PTS? Is there going to be a change to the PTS? And if so, when does that go live?
Well, because the ACS is everything. It's knowledge test, and it's the standard for the knowledge test and the practical test. So in June, and we're saying June 15th, although sometimes depending on when web publication procedures, we will be replacing the PTS for those two documents, for the private pilot airplane and the instrument rating airplane. We're going to retire the PTS, and it will all be the ACS. So apart from there were some editorial changes. For example, you may have noticed that in the practical test standards for private, that because runway safety was and continues to be a big issue, that sometimes there were duplicating tasks, and those all got streamlined into one place. So other than that, you will find that everything that is in the PTS is accommodated in the ACS. We've had lots of eyes looking at that very carefully. So you'll just start using the ACS.
I have to ask, is there going to be a retirement party, or is there a museum where we can go to find these ADF questions in the future?
I hope not.
They're just gone. They're history.
I hope not. Well, we officially use the term when we have the way that we do questions now when we're revising them, we have a board, and the board includes people from a variety of policy divisions, general aviation, commercial, air transportation division. We have one outside stakeholder, university professor, who has obviously signed a non-disclosure agreement, but has some expertise in both aviation and in test question development. We have been getting together twice a week, and an hour at a time is about all we can do. But we go through questions, we look at them, we have a written procedure to go through and look at them. And our official term for when we eliminate a question is we call it archiving. I call it killing, because exactly. That just seems so much more satisfying for some of them.
It makes you feel good, yeah.
Well, there's a certain finality to it, and that's what we like.
There is absolutely finality to it. Well, and one of our members has, I think he's stolen an app from his kid. And he likes to make noises on his iPhone, like machine gun fire and things like that. So we have a lot of fun. I mean, the group is extremely dedicated, because we all care. We want to make it better, and we want to drive training. We want to use testing and certification to drive training to what really matters. And some of the older questions, they didn't do that.
Susan, I wanted to talk about the FAA safety briefing a little bit, and I will confess that as a non-pilot, I guess I'd never really even heard of the FAA safety briefing until recently. And in taking a look at it online, I was really impressed. This is a nice publication. It's got a lot of interesting information. It looks really well produced and well written. Maybe tell our audience, some of whom will be very familiar with the safety briefing, but others who may not be, tell us what the briefing is and who it's directed at and what kind of information it contains.
Oh, sure. Yeah, this is another labor of love. The FAA Safety Briefing magazine, when I first came to the FAA, it was still called FAA Aviation News. We changed it a few years ago because it's a bi-monthly publication, so we publish six times a year. And it wasn't really so much news as it was our mission. And we sat down with a group. We have a great magazine staff. Everybody is extremely dedicated and enthusiastic about what we're doing. We see our mission as being to be the safety policy voice for general aviation pilots, you know, those in personal aviation. There are a lot of resources that go to our friends in the air carrier industry for obvious reasons, but we wanted to make sure that we were speaking, we alone can use, talk about FAA policy on issues that are of interest to pilots. And because quite a few of our staff, including me, of course, we are pilots. We got one person who's has a mechanic certificate. We speak the language. We're part of the world that we're trying to address. So we're trying to make sure that we provide information that is relevant to people. We try certainly to make it entertaining and informative. And, you know, not dry, stodgy stuff. In fact, I strictly forbid that. We just can't have it.
And you have the power.
And I do. It's a beautiful thing. I have more than once killed articles that I didn't think were sufficiently interesting. But what we're really looking for, we're certainly not looking to duplicate what the trade press does. We have a focus or a theme for every issue. And, of course, not every article fits into that, but we try to make sure that everything ties together so that our issues are not just informative for now, but they can be a reference for later. So our July-August issue, which we're just now beginning to plan, I know you're going to be shocked to hear that it's going to focus on training in the ACS. We focused on recent issues. We've had issues that have been very popular on era. We call it the era medical, where we try to talk about, you know, FAA medical policies. And we had a really successful issue, one we call New Technologies. I think it was probably November, December, we focused on night flying. And so we try to tie everything together. And again, it's so that it's a seasonally appropriate thing, but also to do it in a way that the information lasts and you could hopefully use it as a reference.
Now, I found it online. I was looking at the PDF, but I also see that it's available as an EPUB and a format for the Kindle. Maybe you can describe the ways you can subscribe to this or find back issues?
Well, first of all, all the back issues are available online at the web page that you found. And in this day and age, we have gone to one of our folks is very good at this sort of thing, and he has engineered the process to make sure that we are available in a variety of different formats. And I'm kind of like everybody else. I live on my iPad, but my mother is a subscriber. So the government publication office. And if you look online, it will tell you how to subscribe. I'm not going to try to remember the link for you, cause I'm afraid I'll get it wrong.
And we'll put that link in the show notes. So everybody will be able to find it easily. Yes.
We also have, there's QRF codes, the quick reference codes, so you can scan that and get to the subscription point, and that's on the magazine. There are plenty of people who do subscribe to paper copies, and one of the things we do with the paper copies is they are used to support FAA safety team activities. When I did more seminars in my area, I used to always take an armload of magazines, and I called them my party favors. I would put them on the chairs, and you know, while people are sitting there waiting for the official program to start, hey, they're reading my magazine. I like that. I really feel like we try to do a service, and it's very gratifying when I'll be Googling here and there, and I will see articles that have been in a magazine that have been picked up and used in other places or referred to, and I think that, you know, we tend to have more of a reach than we sometimes realize. We also have a Twitter stream. We're very active in social media, and the magazine contributes pretty heavily to the FAA's Facebook feed as well as its Twitter feed. So, you know, we're really trying to make sure that we are working and operating where people are.
Yeah, that Twitter feed is FAA Safety Brief. Very simple.
Yes.
Susan, who writes the articles? Where do you find the writers for the publication?
Well, sometimes we twist arms. I think we've twisted Max's a time or two. A lot of the articles are written by staff. We have a great staff, and you'll see their names in the front of the magazine. I write quite a few, including some ghostwriting, and I found out a long time ago there's a reason they call that blinking thing on the computer the cursor. More than once I have sat there thinking, what in the heck am I going to write about this time? And then somehow it just always comes through. So it's like, you know, what I guess sculptors do. You take a piece of marble and you start chipping until the shape of it appears. We do have people who offer to write for us, and we have an editorial calendar, and we get periodically we get people who want to write or they want to be part of it, and we always send them the submission guidelines, and we send them our, you know, what our policies are, what our editorial guidelines are, and we try to fit them in. So lately we have not had any problem filling the magazine. If anything, we've had we've had to turn pieces away.
Well, one of the articles from the recent episode that I liked a lot was Combating the Startle Effect. I thought that was kind of an interesting read.
Oh, yeah. That was written by one of our staff writers, and that was Sabrina Wood. She's very good. Managing editor is Tom Hoffman. We also have James Williams and Paul Cianciolo. James Williams does a lot of the photos, and he's lead photo editor, and Paul Cianciolo is the social media lead, and he's very good at it. The folks do a really, really great job.
Well, and I know that speaking of writing, that you've also done writing that hasn't been attributed to you, and that's writing speeches sometimes in the past for FAA administrators and folks like that. And also, I know I've seen you around the country at various major events, Oshkosh, Sun and Fun. And I'm trying to remember, did you go to Sun and Fun this year?
I did.
Ooh, tell us about it and what you were doing.
I had a great time. Well, government going to conferences is very highly scrutinized. So unfortunately, I've missed the past few of Sun and Funs and Oshkoshes. But because of the ACS this year, I was able to go. And I did a presentation in the FAA Safety Center about the ACS. Got to see a lot of friends, and I love going to these events, not just because I enjoy presenting, but I enjoy hearing other people present and going around to see people and places and things, and to get a sense of what technology is new and what are the, it's another way to stay really closely connected to what's really going on in the aviation world. And I think it's important for us to do that.
All right. Well, Susan, we'll put links in the show notes to where folks can find the FAA safety briefing online, some of the other resources that you've mentioned. Are there any personal places online that you'd like to hang out where folks might be interested in following you?
I'm on social media at Aviatrix, and you can put that in too. That's the Twitter feed. I have a Facebook page, which is similar to that. I also have a blog, and you can put that in. I think it was on the show notes. I decided a while back that I wanted to just go ahead and compile all the writing that I've done for the magazine, at least in my own name, in one place so that I could find it, and also just as a portfolio should I ever need it. But I also have compiled a few. It's mostly the articles that I've written over the years, and it's indexed and so on, but I also have a piece in there that I quote from frequently. I have 31 what I call big rules for the little things in life, they're just strictly for fun. I think it starts out with rule number one is I don't do anything that involves bugs, dirt, perspiration, or ugly shoes.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
And another one is that it's good to be krill in the bureaucratic food chain because the harpoons are sized to hit whales.
That's awesome.
Those are brilliant.
Anyway,
yeah,
I had a good time with those. For a while, I did them like every day for a month, and I was posting them on Facebook and Twitter, and then I compiled them all. And I've posted them in my office, and people come and look at it sometimes and go, really? I said, yep, those are my rules.
Now, those are on your blog, aviatrix.aero. Which section are they in? I didn't see those.
If you look under the if you look in the index, there is there you can find under the big rules for the little things in life. The other one I'll leave you with is that I have a rule that I never shop for groceries on Friday night. Friday nights you can shop for shoes, but not soup. It's just and I actually have friends who police me on that, and they'll call me and say, where are you? And if I say I'm in the store, it's like, not the grocery store. I said, of course not. It's Friday.
All right. Yeah, we'll put links. I just found the big rules for the little things in life. There's a lot of them. There's 31 of them in there. So nice job compiling those, Susan. All right. Well, again, we'd like to thank you for coming on the Airplane Geeks. I know you've got a lot of things going on this evening as we're recording, and so we really appreciate you being able to take a little bit of time to talk to us and our listeners. Again, we'll have links to a lot of these resources in the show notes, so look for them at airplanegeeks.com/397. And again, Susan, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me, and I'm sorry I have to run off. My bosses seem to have some plans for things that I need to get done for them. Imagine that, but they pay me, and that matters.
That's right.
So thank you so much, and I really appreciated the opportunity.
All right, you guys ready for the news?
Ready.
Okay. Yeah.
Sorry.
Oh, my favorite part. I love the news sounder.
Do you want me to play the news? Here's the news. Our first item comes from Reuters. This is Airbus and Siemens to work together on electrically powered planes. Well, Airbus Group CEO Tom Enders says, quote, "We believe that by 2030, passenger aircraft below 100 seats could be propelled by hybrid propulsion systems, and we are determined to explore this possibility together with world-class partners like Siemens." So they've signed a deal to work on these hybrid electric propulsion systems. Brian, do you think someday you'll be cruising along in a United flight powered by electric motors?
Yeah, I don't know if I like the idea of it being 100% electric, but hybrid certainly. I have no issues with that and actually look forward to it.
Yeah, some of the hybrid systems we've seen feature engines of one sort or another that generate electricity, which then power the electric motors for propulsion. And yeah, that's a really different thing, Brian, than an aircraft that's flying on batteries alone, on the charge that it's got with it.
Yeah, and I think they're going to have to really improve the battery technology because of the weight issue.
Batteries are pretty heavy these days.
And because of the, what do they call it, fire issue?
Yeah, for certain kinds, yeah.
Yes,
yeah,
indeed.
Yeah.
I was really surprised to see them talking about aircraft this large. You know, it's kind of been a foregone conclusion in my mind that we would see, four-place electric airplanes, almost immediately. And certainly I know there's some two places out there available for sale today. But it's pretty remarkable to think that you could extend it up to something that big.
And Airbus seems to be pretty active in this area. I mean, we've seen other examples of Airbus taking an interest or participating in alternatively powered, electrical powered aircraft. So that's encouraging. I don't know if Boeing's doing the same or not. Anybody heard anything from Boeing?
You know, I was thinking the same thing about Airbus. We'll leave a pause here in case someone wants to add something about Boeing, but not hearing one. You know, Airbus has recently started a venture capital group here in Silicon Valley where they're funding technologies that they think will be useful for them in the future. And they are also, for example, the major sponsor behind the Perlin High Altitude Glider, which is a project to send a pressurized glider up to 90,000 feet. So it is interesting that they're kind of reaching out in so many of these areas that seem pretty non-traditional for what we typically think of as an airliner company.
Yeah, yeah. And they're taking it seriously. The article mentions that in this deal with Siemens to work together, that there's a team of 200 people working on this. They want to demonstrate the technical feasibility by 2020 of maybe different hybrid electric propulsion systems. So 200 people, that's a lot of, you know, that's a significant corporate commitment. So it sort of demonstrates Airbus is serious about this.
Yep, thinking about the future.
We have another item from, in this case, AvWeb, Experimental Avionics for Certified Aircraft, EAA and Dynan announced STC. So at Sun and Fun, EAA and Dynan Avionics, they announced that they're developing an approved model list, a supplemental type certificate. That's an AMLSTC. And that allows Dynan, is that how you say it, Max?
Yeah, I think that's it, Dynan.
Dynan, that they're D10 EFIS to be installed in certified aircraft. So let's maybe take this kind of a step at a time. First off, what's an EFIS D10A?
First of all, let's pronounce it correctly.
That's an EFIS, right?
Exactly. I think most people call it an EFIS, right?
See, there may be other people. That's the non-pilot talking, right?
Yeah, and there may be other ways that people pronounce it, but I think most commonly they call it the EFIS. So that's an electronic flight instrument system, and typically that would include the electronic displays which have flight instruments on them, and that might also include the multifunction display with maps and things like that. But for sure, it's primarily the flight instruments portion of what you'd see. It would not be the engine instruments and so on. So it's not every piece of glass in a cockpit, but it's particularly the flight instruments that are being represented on a computer display.
And then what's an AML STC?
Yeah, so STC. So the first of all, Dynan has been working primarily in the world of experimental aircraft. So things that are either built by yourself or light sport aircraft essentially fall into that category. The most of the world is certificated aircraft, so Cessna 210s and things that come out of a factory. And the avionics that you can put into these different kinds of aircraft, experimental versus certified, you can think of as two parallel universes. Basically, the things that have been available through Dynan and other manufacturers for experimental have been very low cost, very cutting edge, very innovative, and that's where you've seen a lot of the innovations first appear. And the cost is phenomenal. I mean, this stuff will sometimes be 25 cents on the dollar versus what you would see in the certified world. So just incredibly price effective. And STC is something that allows you to install something into a certified aircraft that wasn't part of the original design of that aircraft. And typically, you just couldn't put things like Dynan's equipment in a certified aircraft. So what the STC says is, wow, now we're giving you authorization to put a D10 EFIS into a Cessna 150, 172, or essentially Piper Warriors and low-end Piper aircraft. Now, in of itself, you might go, okay, well, this is just one particular piece of equipment, limited number of aircraft. But holy cow, this is the camel's tent nose under the tent. This, I think, is possibly the beginning of something really big. If this continues, and I'm guessing it will, this would open the floodgates to let much lower cost instrument, avionics become available in certificated aircraft, and that would be a really large sea change.
So is that sea change, does that mean that pilots will be able to spend less money, or does it mean that they'd be able to add capabilities that they wouldn't otherwise?
Yeah, so you can think that the D10's a good example. It's this first particular product. It's essentially a small kind of miniature backup system that's got all the flight instruments displayed and a small display that could be used for backup. That's something that typically most aircraft don't have in any way, shape, or form. And so now that's additional capability that a Cessna 172 owner can add that he wouldn't have been able to do in the past. So it's, it really does open, I think, the door to new capability and lower cost, and that's pretty exciting.
Yeah, very good. Next up, this is the FAA and the auto industry teaming up. That sounds like sort of a strange combination. What we see here is the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, NHTSA, and the FAA. They plan to hold an event in a few days here, April 22nd. that will include chief executives from, well, not only the major automakers, but also aviation industry leaders. And what they want to do is look at how the collaboration practices that we see in the aviation industry could benefit automakers, particularly safety data sharing. Brian, this kind of goes back to what you were asking earlier about knowledge transfer.
Yeah, absolutely. Wouldn't it be nice to have people share best practices and actually get better across the board on everything?
I think this is a great thing. I mean, this is, we used to call this benchmarking. When you look at a process, in this case, the auto industry, looking at, the number of recalls, right? We've seen a lot of airbag recalls, ignition switches. The recall rate is up over historic levels. And this is a safety issue. So one way to tackle that problem is to go look at other industries that seem to be pretty good at doing this sort of thing. And they've looked at the aviation industry. That speaks highly of aviation. And hopefully it's something that will result in some positive changes for the automotive industry.
And I've seen other industries look to aviation in the past. My recollection is that the medical field has borrowed heavily upon, you know, some of the checklist type practices used in the aviation industry to, you know, kind of standardize surgeries and make sure that items aren't overlooked, you know, much like checklists do in aircraft. So I think it does speak well for the industry. If you look at just the overall, fatality rate in at least commercial aviation, my gosh, you can't get much closer to zero than what we've done with commercial aviation in this country. I think the last fatal accident, other than the Asiana crash that killed three people in San Francisco, the last one prior to that was 2009. I mean, that's as close to zero as you can get.
All right. Next story. This comes from Bloomberg. Three big airlines just trashed your cheap fares. Brian, maybe you can help us understand this, but it seems that American, Delta, and United have taken some actions to, well, I guess, restrict multi-destination fare bargains.
Yeah, so what they want to do, instead of, you're on a business trip, you need to go to three different cities, so you book, you know, point A to B to C to back home, and that's your round trip. Well, that becomes really expensive when you look at what it would cost to just fly each of those segments one way. So savvy travelers would book three one-way tickets, save a bunch of money, and everything's fine. The problem comes in is when something happens along the way and you need to change your ticket. And then the airlines will impose their $200 to $300 change fee, depending if it's domestic or international, and they'll make a ton of money off of this.
Well, and the reason why they're doing this is there's people who were booking multi-leg trips because it was cheaper than flying one leg. Am I wrong? So you're flying.
Yeah,
that's
part of it, but I don't think that's as prevalent as just doing the multi-segment round trip. People would also book tickets and not complete the trip. For example, I could do Los Angeles, Chicago, San Diego with the connection through Los Angeles and just not fly the last section to San Diego. And that ticket would be a lot less expensive than just doing the Los Angeles, Chicago flight, for example.
And this was the subject, wasn't it, of the guy that had the website or has the website that helps facilitate identifying these kinds of bargains, if you will.
Yeah, the hidden cities.
The hidden cities, right, exactly, that the airlines were very upset over, tried to shut this guy down, but in the end, I guess, were unsuccessful in doing that.
Yeah, as far as I know, the website's still up and he's working, yep.
All right, this is an interesting item. This is from the Chicago Sun-Times. Surviving crew of doomed United Flight 232 reunites for play. Now, I think everybody pretty much will recall United Airlines flight 232. That was the DC-10 that had a fan disc failure in the tail-mounted engine. The plane lost its hydraulics, crashed in Sioux City, Iowa, killing 110 passengers, one flight attendant, but 184 people miraculously survived. I think good crew management and good ground rescue activity was responsible for some of those people surviving. But in any event, 8 survivors from the 13-member crew, they reunited to watch a play titled United Flight 232 by Vanessa Stalling. And this play was based on the book that came out in 2014. It was titled Flight 232, A Story of Disaster and Survival. That was written by Lawrence Gonzalez. It's an interesting article, I think, because of some of the stories from and about some of the surviving crew members. I just found it a really compelling article to read. Some of these long articles, you read the first few paragraphs, you get the point, it's time to move on. But I couldn't do that with this one.
I can't imagine how they turned that into a play, unless if they just look at the human side of the story and either how people got on with their lives or what else they're doing. But a play about the crash itself just doesn't seem right to me. I was really hoping that we could talk Rob into going and seeing this, since it's playing in Chicago.
It is playing in Chicago. It's playing at the House Theater in Chicago through May 1st. So if any of you are in that area, you might want to take a look at that. That's the House Theater, again, in Chicago. And yeah, Brian, I don't know anything about the play, really, whether it's the human story or what. The article kind of gets to the human story. I think that some of what happened to these people is kind of interesting. There was a DC-10 flight instructor who was on board, who was credited with helping the pilots fly this plane using differential thrust of the remaining two engines and so forth.
And I think I'm sorry, Max. I think I told this story before. My parents actually met Dennis and his wife on a cruise and became fairly good friends with them. And what I find most interesting about that, and sad in and of itself, is he ended up passing away from the same form of brain cancer that my father passed away from. So it's just interesting that both of them, big aviation guys, and passed away from same brain cancer.
The chief flight attendant was Janice Brown. She's 75 years old now, but she flew for 9 more years after that accident. And ultimately retired. She relates in the article how she handled a situation where there was an infant in the plane that they knew was going to crash towards the end of the flight. And so Janice has actually been working towards a requirement that safety seats for infants on airliners would be required. So I found that very interesting. So there's a lot more other stories or other interesting stories in the article. It's a very, very good read, at least in my opinion.
Yeah, and there really has to be a better way of dealing with infants than wrapping them in a blanket and putting them under the seat in front of you.
Yes.
That just doesn't seem right to
me. Right, that was the process, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, anybody who's not familiar with United 232 story should definitely look it up and read it. I think it's one of the more compelling accidents that's occurred here in the United States. And just look at all of the things that came together. Were as down on their luck, as that crew was, so many other lucky things did happen that really enabled so many people to survive. So it really is just an amazing story.
Yeah, and seriously, if some of you listening, any of you listening, are in the Chicago area and can attend this play, we'd love to hear your feedback on that. Write to us at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com or get in touch with us on social media. If you're able to give us kind of a little review or some impressions from that, that would be really nice.
Yeah, Max, maybe we could put it in the show notes. There's the Air Crash Investigations show. It's available on YouTube that talks about United Flight 232.
Ah, okay. One final item, and this is kind of an update. We've talked about Solar Impulse 2 before several times. And in fact, we spoke with Andre Borschberg back in episode 361. He was the Solar Impulse 2 pilot that flew from Japan to Hawaii. But they needed to put the around-the-world journey on a hold because they had some battery damage from overheating. And we described that, or Andre described that for us back in episode 361. And so we get information that now Solar Impulse 2 is going back into mission mode. They plan to take off from Hawaii as soon as they have a good weather window. And so that's especially encouraging. You can follow that flight at solarimpulse.com. Take a look at that.
Yeah, and that website was just spectacular when they are in flight. And who knows, by the time people are listening to this, the flight may have already taken off. So definitely go out to that website and see if they're up in the air. It's so much fun to watch live video of the pilot in the cockpit and see all the telemetry. I think it's one of the best done live sites for an aviation project I have ever seen. So hats off to that group for really putting together a compelling site that engages people and just shares the adventure with us.
And now it's time for David Vanderhoof with his history segment. David, what do you have for us this time?
Well, I'm invoking rule number one, but for a special occasion.
Okay.
This is episode 397. We have just 3 weeks until we record episode 400. So I was thinking, what should I do to celebrate 400 episodes and maybe 250-plus history segments? I really don't know how many there actually are, but it's more than 10 and less than 400. My first thought was to do the complete history of the DJI Phantom, since we are up to 4. But then I realized that would fly into the face of all the airline pilots who listen to the show. But there were other ideas. I needed something different, something special. Like, how about the history of commuting with your wife to Pratt & Whitney? Or... seat pitch, a history of people getting bigger, seats getting smaller. Why the Delta? The history of iPhone aerial photography over Northern California, or who's flying the airplane? You've heard of Brian's song? Well, how about Brian's Woe, a United story? Airplane geek widows, why they can't wait for Monday nights. A history of the podcast, the stylings of Mary and Benet. Of course, there's so much rich content from our Commonwealth contributors. Flight Upside Down, a history of hot air training down under. See what I did there, PCDU? A boy with a girl's name who ran away to Canada for airplanes. The SB6 CMU, the plane the FAA made to make the Gannett look pretty, or lightning in the bottle. And last but not least, I finally settle on this one. The Rob Marx story, or how we stopped worrying and learned to love drones. Then I thought, okay, well, I'll leave it open to you, the people who listen to me drone on for these years now. What should I do? But before you say I want the complete history of the mosquito in Maine, there are rules. If you have hounded me to do a specific aircraft in the past, you're automatically disqualified. And you all know who you are. I want someone new to be rewarded. No, it will not be a C-130 or a tanker. There will be no passing gas for this segment. Now listen carefully, and I'll make sure the rules are listed on the show notes at airplanedeeks.com/397. Not following directions might void your entry. 1. Pick your airplane. Send it to the geeks at airplanegeeks.com with the subject, David, please do this plane. In the body, give me the full name of the plane. In 20 words or less, tell me why I should do it. Creativity will be rewarded, emojis won't. Give me your name. How long have you listened to the show? What picture is associated with this post at airplanegeeks.com? That way I know you read the rules. Should you have picked one that I have already done, I will give you a second chance, I promise. And you have until April 30th, 2016 to get your entry in. Keep in mind that all decisions by the historian are final. So go out and do some research, and I look forward to hearing from you, especially if you haven't written in before. So in preparation of episode 400, this is David M. Vanderhoof, your airplane historian, looking for your suggestions, and have a good night.
David, that's brilliant. Now, none of us knew this was coming.
No, and I'm just some of those things sounded like they might have something to do with the show co-host. Am I correct on that? Just a lucky guess there.
Oh, very good.
I have my two favorites. One was seat pitch, the history of people getting bigger, seats smaller, why the Delta. And for those people who don't know, Delta means change.
Right, exactly.
You know, and of course, my wife was like, well, she likes Monday nights and some other ones. And so, yeah, I think I hit everybody. If I missed anything, sorry, Brian, but, you know, a United story is definitely you.
Yeah. And I actually fly on other airlines besides United. I guess love to pick on them the most.
This is actually a perfect night for us to tell the Rob Mark story. I mean, we could just make it up and there would be no one to refute it.
Yeah. Certainly not Rob.
Exactly.
All right. All right, David, thanks. That's a brilliant idea. Brilliant idea. I love it. All right. Well, let's do a little What's Up with the Geeks segment. It turns out that pretty much all of us have been really busy these days doing some interesting things. I'll kick it off, and Brian will help. As you know, Brian and I attended Aviation Geek Fest 2016 in Seattle and the surrounding environment. Brian, I've posted online just how much of a fantastic experience it was. You know, how much we got to see and do and learn, and the people we got to meet, and Isaac Alexander doing just a wonderful job of being one of the organizers, one of the ringleaders of this
Co-MC.
Event. Co-MC. What kind of impressions did you walk away from?
There was so much. It was really great being able to now be on the production floor at both Airbus and Boeing. So that was certainly special. Getting down there, I was shocked over the number of people that came up to me and said, "You're Brian Coleman from the Airplane Geeks, aren't you? I could tell by your voice." I'm like, "What? Hello?" So, yeah, I guess I'm recognized through my voice. That really surprised me. The level of knowledge of our fellow airplane geeks just really amazed me. They, you know, had encyclopedic knowledge just the same way David does. So just imagine being surrounded by 250 Davids. that was really impressive.
Yes.
Seeing the Dreamlifter up close was really special. I mean, there were just so many moments throughout the event that were great. You know, how nice the people were.
Yeah, that was very, very true. People were very helpful. We toured the Boeing's Everett plant where they assemble the 787 and the 777. That was fascinating. We also toured the Renton facility where the 737 is built. We got to see the first Boeing 737 MAX test aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
The Dreamliner gallery was just fantastic. We had a great tour of that. This is where they do the configuration on the 787. When I say they, I mean the airlines. One of the strategies for the 787 is that, as opposed to other aircraft where the owner has to go and contract with the seat manufacturer, with the people who do the carpeting, with people who make
galleys,
lavatories, coffee machines. Instead of traipsing around the world, kind of coordinating all that for your new aircraft, what they do is the airlines send a team to this facility, And all of those options are right there. And I mean physically. Here's a row of lavatories. Here's 50 different coffee makers for the gallery. Here's this, here's that. Everything that you could or all the things that you need to make decisions about are right there.
The quantity of fabric for the seats and the carpet samples, all the different patterns, all the colors. Yes. It was amazing.
Part of the idea is just to make the purchase decision and the configuration decisions much easier for the airlines or the operators of the aircraft. So that was really impressive. There's the Museum of Flight, the Future of Flight Museum. We saw that. Got into the Future of Flight Restoration Center. That was really fascinating. And the people. I mean, like you say, Brian. Many listeners, many new friends. You met John and Sam, Carl, Camillus, and her friend Bruce, Neil, Christy, Tom from CNN was there. Rohat from Airwise was there. Just a really, really fantastic group of people. It's like you say, Brian.
Yeah, so many.
Yeah, like 250 people of the sort that listen to this show. I just highly recommend it. We'll put some links in the show notes. I kind of captured all of my photos in an album. Brian, did you put yours somewhere? I saw an email from you,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, they're in Dropbox.
Okay, so do we have them out where folks can, click on a link and get to an album of them or something like that?
No, I just shared it with you.
Oh, okay, all right. So look for some of that in the show notes for this episode, and if you have any possibility in the future to enter the lottery, basically to get tickets to Aviation Geek Fest 2017. Highly, highly recommend it. This is a must attend, once in your lifetime anyway, kind of event. And a number of people there, Brian, actually had been two or three times.
Yeah, multiple times. Yeah, I was shocked over that. And people from all around the world. What, there were two from Australia, from India, the Soviet Union.
Ireland.
Ireland, yeah. The quantity of international folks that made the journey was really impressive too. I also want to give a shout out to both Bonnie and Sandy of the Future of Flight, and they were fantastic and really helped out a lot in at least making this happen for me. So and just the effort that they and their team put into producing this event, it was just outstanding.
Yeah, they're professionally done. The only glitch, at least that we were aware of, was during Randy Tinseth's talk. Randy is the director of sales and marketing for Boeing.
Oh, yes.
And this was in the museum. Now, as you might suspect, Seattle weather features, maybe more clouds and rain than other areas of the country. So the sun had not yet set. The weather was just gorgeous. It was beautiful and sunny.
Yeah, I take all the credit for bringing Southern California weather to Seattle. And it was raining in Los Angeles, so it was perfect.
Really? Yeah. Well, when Randy was giving his presentation, he had a PowerPoint. He had slides on a huge screen behind him. The problem was that there was sunlight streaming through the spaces between some of the sort of blinds, if you will, along one wall, and it made it a little bit difficult to really read the slides, but you knew what he was talking about. So, I mean, it wasn't a big problem, but yeah, afterwards, I was talking to Sandy, someone who said that we had no idea that was even a problem because we've never seen the sun shine through those, while doing a presentation. So that was the only glitch, and it was a small one, but... And again, many, many, many thanks to Isaac Alexander, Jet City Star on Twitter, for all that he did for us and for the event.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, with that, David, tell us a little bit more about what's happening in your life coming up soon.
I'm healthy enough to go to air show season.
Yay.
That's a big deal. In fact, I've been walking 2 to 3 miles a day just so I'm prepped for air show season. But we have a lovely relationship with NASA. And I'm going to Langley Air Force Base for the air show but we're friends with NASA. So I said, well, any chance that I could come over and see the NASA side, and through our favorite NASA historian, Bill, I was connected with the public affairs office. And on Friday, I have lined up interviews with Rich Walls, the Advanced Air Vehicles Program Strategic Technical Advisor, who can talk about futuristic aircraft, green aviation, and X-planes. That's followed by Peter Cohen, Commercial Supersonic Technology Project Manager, who will be talking about the Quest X-plane. Frank Jones, Research Directorate Deputy Director, who can talk about Cirrus SR-22 and UAS testbed, including sense and avoid flights in North Dakota. And last but not least, Danette Allen, Autonomy Incubator Lead, who can talk about autonomy research for UAS and the proposed Mars Flyer. So I will be doing a lot of recording on Friday on behalf of our two shows. So I'm looking forward to it. And then Saturday will be a joyful day of watching Raptors and F-35s and F-16s and F-18s and sucking in all that Air Combat Command has to offer. Hopefully the weather holds out, though we've had drop-dead gorgeous weather, and it looks like it might be raining this weekend. But wow. I'm looking forward to spending the day at NASA and bringing home a lot of stuff for us to listen to.
Wow, I'm so envious. Wow.
Yeah, David, I'm so jealous. We need to coordinate better, because I would love to join you in that event. Who knows, maybe you're doing this on purpose, but had I known, I would have been able to leave for my trip for Germany. So I'm not going to be here next Monday because I'm going to be in Germany, but I could have left from the East Coast instead of the West Coast. And gosh darn it, you're going to have a great time.
Yeah, that sounds fantastic. Amazing.
Yeah, there was one thing about that. You said they're going to be doing sense and avoid testing. Aren't they kind of cheating if they're doing that in North Dakota?
I mean, What's there to avoid? Well...
Oh, apologies to our North Dakota listeners.
and the UAS test site listeners who, at Grand Forks, who we're friends with, he doesn't know what he's talking about, but
it's a joke, people. It's kind of flat, not too many tall buildings there.
I know. And this is coming from someone who's going to Accident Wise in 2016.
It's true.
So tell us about that. What do you, what's Accident Wise 2016?
Well, it's a safety event that the Aero Club cooked up last year, and we're doing it in conjunction with some co-sponsors, AOPA Foundation, the NASA ASRS, which is their Aviation Safety Reporting System Division, and Cirrus Aircraft. So the four organizations have put together a great evening at a really outstanding location. It's at Moffett Field, which is kind of a historical airport. It was really kind of iconic. Anytime you're driving through Silicon Valley, you can see the Hangar 1 from miles around, which was built, over 80 years ago for a massive airship, which has long since gone. But we've lined up some amazing speakers. We scored the number two person in the FAA. So Mike Whitaker, who's the FAA Deputy Administrator, is our keynote speaker. He's going to be talking about, get this, the integration of unmanned aircraft, which are also sometimes called drones, into the National Airspace System.
So using sense and avoid technology in from Grand Forks, North. Funny how this all ties together.
It does. It does. We also have Bruce Landsberg, who I think AOPA members will remember.
Yes.
He was in the leadership AOPA for over 20 years, wrote a magazine column there for at least that long, was formerly head of the Air Safety Institute. He is an outstanding speaker. He's going to be talking about his 80-20 rule of GA safety. We've got Linda Connell, who's been on our show here. Linda is the director of NASA's ASRS, so she will be talking about that program. And then I'll be speaking about recent San Francisco Bay Area fatal accidents. On top of that, we've got a number of exhibitors, door prizes, just a fun time for all. Oh, and Lightspeed. Lightspeed's exhibiting, and there's going to be a silent auction for one of their new headsets. So 6 p.m., get there early, Moffett Field. Just drive straight to the building right next to Hangar 1, so it should be a fun time for everyone.
So that must be a noise-canceling headset, right?
It is.
Yeah, so it's a silent auction for a noise cancellation headset. I think that's kind of funny.
Exactly right. Yeah, so Thursday, April 28th, 6 p.m.
Okay. All right. Well, we're all having more fun than we probably deserve. If you're having aviation fun as well or have recently, tell us about it. Send us a story. Send us some of your thoughts on some of the things that you have coming up in your life aviation-wise or some of the recent things maybe that are notable. Send those to thegeeks at airplanegeeks.com. We'd love to hear from you on that.
Or make a recording so you don't have to read it.
That's even better. That's way better. it's actually very easy. Most smartphones have recording functions, and just get yourself in a quiet place, press play, and let it rip. And if it's really horrible, well, we can always edit it a little bit to help you out. So
record, that's what I have to do about five times, but sometimes. Maybe it's me.
Yes, yes. All right, well, let's move on to some of the listener mail that we've received. We've got so much lately. It's kind of frustrating because it's impossible to mention them all. But we heard from Fawn Allen Duke. He said he wanted to pass along a link to the Aviation Crash Heat Map. And this is a project that he did on, as some others, on a data set released by the NTSB. And this map shows all the recorded aviation crashes that were handled by the NTSB for about 30 or so years, he says. The project happened during the development of a first responder application for helping identify aviation crash sites and where the debris field could be at the crash site. So he says that he'd like to get the word out about these solutions so that folks are aware of them and can benefit from them. So that's the Aviation Crash Heat Map. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. It's crash.mojavedata.gov/heatmap. But again, link in the show notes. So thanks to Fawn for sending that along. And we heard from Tom. Tom sent us a link to a story about the a B-57 bomber that was flown like a fighter. So this is an article from the B-57 Canberra Association, and it's about the pilot, Ed Ryder. It says he came along through the enlisted ranks. He'd done a stint as an airborne electronics technician on the B-57. 10 years later, he was a captain flying the Canberra out of Fanrang. This guy Ryder, he was known for his aggressive flying style and his particular tactics, it says, that were more suited to a nimble fighter bomber than a big B-57. It says by Ryder's own admission, quote, "There were only about two navigators left who would fly with me." He said before the war was over, he had completed more than 400 combat missions, and it tells of an account of one mission, anyway. And, you know, when you read this, some people tell a story, and, you know, it just draws you in, and this is one of those. Just to give you a little taste of it, he says, and this is his quote, Ryder's account, "Other than the two navigators in the squadron who would willingly fly with me, the others did not like my highly unorthodox tactics. I tried to point out to them that other pilots were getting shot up or shot down, while I never took hits and killed more trucks than most. Those idiots were coming back with their airplanes full of holes and getting medals for it. Anyway, my navigator came down with a bad case of hose revenge, and the other navigator was already flying, so someone had to be volunteered. The hand of fate laid its clammy finger on Bill. After an earlier adventure that ended in a belly landing due to a hydraulic failure, he had sworn never to fly with me again. We had to drag him scratching and spitting, so to speak, to the airplane." So it goes on, and the stories are really entertaining and enjoyable. And, you know, maybe with the passage of time, some of these get kind of
colorful.
I don't know. I'm not saying that's the case here, but they are definitely colorful stories. So
I hang out with a group of ex-military on a regular basis that are all retired, and most of them are Vietnam vets, and the stories get longer, more aggressive, and far more entertaining the older we become. So,
and that's I'm good with that. I mean, the entertainment is, you know, worth it. So, we also heard from Ben Granucci, our friend from NYCAviation.com. Ben writes, I just wanted to follow up on the question of slots at Newark Liberty International Airport, EWR. He said, the FAA announced that as of October 30th, this year, 2016, EWR will no longer have slot constraints. An increase in on-time performance at the airport has resulted in it being upgraded from level 3 to level 2. As a level 2 airport, the FAA will work with airlines to schedule flights within the capacity of the airport. Their hope is that this move will encourage more competition there, particularly among new entrants and airlines with only a few flights. That was the group that had complained about the lack of access they faced to EWR. It also means that the DOJ's suit against United and Delta seeking to block their effective slot swap has been withdrawn. So thanks to Ben for that update. Very fascinating. We'll pass along some information, too, that we received that the United States Aircraft Insurance Group, USAIG, they're an aviation-specific provider of insurance. They are offering some downloadable computer, desktop, and tablet wallpaper and screensaver versions of their safety posters. So check that out at usaig.com. Look under the safety tab, and then there's a subsection, safety posters and wallpaper. So you might find some images that you like there.
And they've got some safety slogans on them. I'm just looking at one right now. It says, be responsible. If you can't report properly rested, tell a supervisor. Don't operate at risk. I was just laughing because I know that Arianna Huffington has a very popular book out right now on sleep and how important that is. So, yeah, I guess the message is being delivered all over these days. We need our sleep.
We do. I know I do.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree.
Yeah. We heard from our previous guest, John Mollison. He is the guy that you'll recall makes these fantastic drawings of aircraft, particular aircraft that were flown by aviators in the past. And he combines the artwork with the story of that particular aviator. Well, after he was on and after we had some conversations and our guests talking about the WASPs, we actually tried to help facilitate putting some folks together. And it looks like John has been in contact with one of the WASPs, B. Haydu, and he has produced a drawing of her PT-17, which is really, really gorgeous. David, this drawing, it just blows me away. We'll put a picture of it in the show notes, I think, so folks can take a look at it. But gorgeous PT-17 Stearman.
Stearmans are cool, and especially when you correct the star and bar on it.
You did a little. I guess you did a little editing of, or made a suggestion. As to the accuracy.
John wanted a suggestion, and I asked him a question that, given his markings, was he really sure that he was putting that airplane at that time? And he came back and said, no, and he corrected the markings. So I was kind of happy that we went on authenticity, but that's why I'm a modeler and a geek.
And that's what John really strives for. I mean, so it was an accurate marking, correct? Just not from that particular time period? Is that
what it was he had picked a marking, which is a red surround around the U.S. star and bar, which was only flown from June to August 1943. It had a bit of a problem that pilots in the Pacific were seeing red and shooting first and then checking what they were shooting at later. So immediately the marking came off and was replaced with a blue surround. So I had that red star and bar, in all fairness, is one of my favorite markings from World War II, because it really locks in when that aircraft was being flown in and active, et cetera. It's a giant red flag, excuse the pun. So I said, John then went back and looked at his research and realized B didn't fly until late 1944. So he's pretty sure that that red surround would have been painted out because the directive said by September 1st they were to be painted out. So he went back and put the blue surround on it. And that's the photograph that Max will put. The final one after the edit will be up on the show notes. So, but that, it was kind of cool. It was really nice that he was agreeable. We had a very wonderful conversation about markings, and I'm glad I could help to make a accurate photograph or an accurate drawing even more accurate.
Yeah, wonderful. And of course, you can find John at his website, johnmollison.com. It's MOLLISON.com. Also, we talked about, and you can find some really great aviation stories at oldguysandtheirairplanes.com.
And Max, one other thing real quick about John. I liked his artwork so much, I went ahead and bought two of the prints.
Did you?
From his site. Yeah.
Aren't they nice?
The Corsair and B-17. So they're off getting framed right now, and as soon as I get them back, I'll take some pictures, and maybe we could put them in a future show note.
Yes.
But John sent me his business cards, and these have to be the coolest business cards, and I'm going to make a pitch that we actually make them for us at the Airplane Geeks. They're actually cutouts of aircraft, so you could put them together and make a flying airplane out of the business card. He sent an extra set for you. Going to send them to you. They're so cool.
I know that he had, or I knew that he had something special to do with business cards when we had John on the show, but we didn't have time to get to that. So yeah, I'm glad we've been able to discover just what that is. Yeah, I look forward to seeing that. That sounds really cool.
Yeah, how does that work? I mean, are there multiple punch outs that you have to put together, or is it a single punch out? Or
yeah, you basically destroy the business card, but okay. You get this really cool flyable airplane as a result. Yeah, paper airplane. Yeah, very, very cool. And there's one in metal and one in paper.
And is it a standard sized business card, or is it a bit larger?
Yeah, no, standard sized card. So it's a really small paper airplane.
Oh, well, you said one in metal. You can make a metal airplane too.
Wow. Yeah, I haven't taken that one apart yet to fly it, but yeah.
I'm loving it.
Can you put it back together as a business card? Or?
Yeah, probably.
Oh, okay. Let's see. We'll finish up with an email from James. He said he's been listening to the podcast for a couple of years now. He says he really enjoys it. Thanks for taking the time to do something so worthwhile. Thank you, James, for listening. He says he mostly listens while he's on his push bike on his way to and from work in Sydney. He's a design engineer by trade in avionics. He says a lot of people have a lot to say about aircraft that were designed in their country of birth, but, you know, sometimes you have to give credit where credit's due, and I guess it's all the more genuine if you do. He says, I came across these stunning and rather brutal pictures of the Russian Lun Ekranoplan and thought them worthy of sharing. Amazing to think this wasn't the biggest of its kind. So this is an aircraft. We talked about this aircraft once before, didn't we, David? Am I remembering correctly?
Wig. Huh? It's a wig.
It's a wig?
It's a wig. Wing and ground effect.
Oh, that's right. That's right. So this post is in Russian. We'll put a link in the show notes, maybe even a photo. From it. This is that
Google Translate kind of works.
Yeah, it kind of works. Yeah, it's not too bad, actually. This is that gigantic, odd-looking
flying boat.
Flying boat that really does fly.
That's also a missile launcher?
Probably. It's certainly big enough. So there's a lot of really, really nice, high-resolution images in this post. And so take a look at that in the show notes for this episode.
So, David, is this one of these 6 feet above the water type deals, or how high does this fly off the water?
That's what you're talking about.
Okay.
You never get out of ground effect.
Yep.
It flies, but it doesn't fly. It flies sort of. I don't know. It's
a ground effect
It's just remarkably huge, and I don't know. I want to use the word ugly, but it's pretty odd looking.
Well, the other part about it is you got to remember that it had split bow doors, so they could discard large tanks. It was an amphib.
Yeah.
It was high speed amphibious assault. Wow. Not that I would know anything about amphibious assault other than my father lived it in World War II.
Yeah.
But no, originally the Russians wanted to use it as a high-speed amphibious assault, or a missile way attack aircraft carriers. Is you send these things out and they fire missiles at long range at the aircraft carriers and sink the aircraft carriers.
So is this a one-off?
No, they built quite a few of them.
Really?
Yeah, but they never. Luckily, the Soviet Union collapsed under its own weight. Otherwise, we might have actually seen more of them. It's another one of those technologies that was coming of age just in time for the Soviet Union to collapse. So they didn't get made.
Mm-hmm. Probably just as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Really.
Hate to see one of these used in anger.
Mm. All right. Well, I think that's going to have to do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. We want to thank all of you for listening. We really, really appreciate it. We want to thank our guest, Susan Parson. She's a special technical assistant with the FAA Flight Standards Service, and she's also editor of FAA Safety Briefing Magazine. If you haven't seen that before, take a look. Really kind of a professional publication. Nicely done. All right. Well, let's tell folks where they can find each of us online. David Vanderhoof, we'll start with you. Caught you off guard, did I?
Yeah, as I'm coughing again. You can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof, and you can find me on Fridays with that guy, Max Flight, on the UAV Digest, talking about unmanned aerial vehicles and sense and avoid in North Dakota.
Yeah, that's right. And Brian Coleman, how do folks find you?
The best place to get a hold of me is brian@airplanegeeks.com. And if anyone has any extra pennies, I'm quite happy to accept donations at airplanegeeks.com/Farnborough2016 to help fund the trip to Farnborough and get some great recordings like what David's going to be doing this weekend. But from England.
Absolutely. Yeah, we really appreciate that, Brian, and getting a on the ground eye view of Farnborough would be just wonderful. So thanks for that. Max Trescott, where do people find you?
Oh, I'm sorry. I was busy here writing out my apology letters to listeners in North Dakota. I'll get right back to you here. No, and I'm sure everybody knows it's a joke. I've been to North Dakota. Yes, I enjoyed my visit there, and we love all our listeners. And we joke about different places and things and people. So anyway, you can find me online at Facebook, Twitter, or you can find my books at g1000book.com.
Great. And I'm Max Flight. Find me as Max Flight on Twitter. Look for me there on LinkedIn. As David mentioned, at the UAVDigest.com. Also with Mary Kirby on the PaxX podcast.com. In fact, our next guest, we're getting ready to record with the guy, the Aero Patent guy. Looking forward to that. Look for me also at the Airplane Geeks listener team. You can learn more about that at airplanegeeks.com/team. We're at airplanegeeks.com. You'll find links to all the social media places that you can follow us there on the website. Show notes are at airplanegeeks.com/397. Take a look at that. You'll find links to all the social media places where you can find and follow us. Also links to the articles we talk about, the resources, some photographs, all kinds of great stuff. airplanegeeks.com/397. Intro music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. Outro is by Bruno Massone. Find more of his really interesting compositions that incorporate aviation sounds at brunomassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Keep the blue side up.
And thanks for listening. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back.